The Georgia voting lie exposed. Joe Biden walked back yet again in a travesty at Princeton. We'll discuss all this and more on this edition of The Editors. I'm Rich Lowry, and I'm joined as always by the Right Honorable Charles C.W. Cook, Alexander Zandesanctis, and the Sage of Authenticity Woods, Jim Garrity. You are, of course, listening to a National Review podcast. Our sponsors this episode are Allegiance Gold, Tommy John, and Quip. More about all of them in due course. If for some reason you're not already following us on a streaming service out there, you can find us everywhere from Spotify to iTunes. If you like what you hear here, please consider giving us a glowing five-star review on iTunes. If you don't like what you hear here, please forget I said anything. And before we get into it in earnest, let me say a few words about Allegiance Gold, the official gold IRA of the Editors podcast. Inflation rates, of course, are a growing concern for Americans with retirement accounts. Allegiance Gold can help you protect your IRA 401k with physical gold and silver. They'll also give you $500 of free silver. That's $500 of free silver with a qualified purchase. Call 844-790-9191, 844-790-9191, or visit allegiancegold.com/editors. That's allegiancegold.com/editors. Please check it out. So, Jim, we're recording Tuesday morning, have a big primary day in Georgia today. Know the results tonight. But let's talk a little bit about what we've seen in the early and absentee voting, which is a huge surge in early and absentee votes, way above the last pre-pandemic midterm in 2018. No comparison of an election year is ever going to be with another, is ever going to be a pure apples to apples comparison. But this is a sign there is indeed no voter suppression in Georgia. This was always a ridiculous lie. The things that they said were going to suppress the vote and target African-American voters were just nonsense. This provision saying you can't give food and drink in the line while people are waiting in the polling place was just meant to stop electioneering. Doesn't mean you can't have, you know, food and drink set up some distance from the line. In fact, that's what various activists have been doing this year, although there are not many lines yet, and changing, you know, the verification for an absentee ballot, going from signature match to writing your driver's license or social security number. These are never going to suppress any votes whatsoever. And we've seen this surge to prove that these weren't major obstacles or any obstacles to voting at all. And we haven't really heard any apologies or explanations from all the people who said this was a racist version of Jim Crow or Jim Crow 2.0 or a system that was going to make Jim Crow look like Jim Eagle, as Joe Biden somewhat bafflingly said a couple months ago.
Yeah, Rich, you just start wondering if at some point Biden would just keep coming up with bigger and bigger birds. It's not just Jim Eagle, it's Jim Ostrich. It's Jim Pterodactyl. That's how bad this law is. Rich, I would not hold my breath for the apologies or reevaluations or anything like that. I also kind of wonder if you are a progressive activist on the left, turnout at this point doesn't matter. You won. You got Major League Baseball to move the All-Star game. You got people to believe, at least at the time, that this was a terrible racist law that was going to suppress that. And by getting Major League Baseball to you know, by getting, like, the name of the game is to get corporations to be afraid of not doing what the left wants. So they cracked the whip. Major League Baseball chose to move the All-Star game. That's a win. What happens after that is immaterial to the average progressive leftist. They have enacted their, you know, they've managed to make somebody do something they didn't necessarily want to do in the name of placating the woke activist class. In terms of the turnout, I do think we should note there's a slim chance that this high early vote turnout is sort of, I guess the term is cannibalizing the election day turnout. It's very early as we're recording this. So far, there are lines in certain areas. My guess, I'd be very surprised if the total turnout, though, in 2022 did not exceed the total turnout in the 2018 primaries. So, yes, this has not been a voter suppression law, or if it is a voter suppression law, it is the least effective one of all time because turnout is indeed turning up higher. So, look, yeah, I think this is a demonstration that these laws are not bad. They are not malevolent. They are not part of a secret agenda or something like that. And I think probably one of the other kind of curiosity I'm you know, say, looking to see to this evening is not just the total turnout, but considering how, as of this recording on May 24th, we're still waiting for a winner in the Pennsylvania Senate race, whether there's a clear winner. Now, it looks like the big statewide races in Georgia, the Republican primary of Kemp versus Perdue and the Senate primary where it's Herschel Walker running over everyone, much like he did in college football, we'll probably have an early night tonight. They'll probably both be called either right as polls close or shortly thereafter. They're both way ahead in the polls and things like that. But all in all, this, you know, it looks like by the end of, you know, by tomorrow morning, we'll be saying, wow, you know, Georgia's primary elections went really well. And all of the drama and all of the wailing and all the crying we saw about a year ago will turn out to have been utterly ridiculous and yet another case of liberals and progressives basically getting to invent an alternate reality and then convincing most of the media that that alternate reality is in fact reality.
Yes, and it's impossible to exaggerate how dire the warnings were about this Georgia law. The president of the NAACP, I should say, literally said, our democracy stands in its final hour. There was that shameful line from Biden's speech in January attacking the law, saying, do you want to be on the side of Martin Luther King or George Wallace, John Lewis or Bull Connor, Abraham Lincoln or Jefferson Davis, over these relatively minor tweaks to Georgia election law that, as I said, didn't seem to have any, likely to have any pernicious effect at the time. And now it's clear that they haven't.
I think it was always clear, even at the time, that this was not what Democrats were pretending it was going to be. Now we have the cold, hard evidence of that, but it was always a ridiculous claim, and they knew that. There was, we didn't have the boots on the ground evidence like we do now that what they were saying was false. But anyone who looked at the law, actually paid attention to what it would do, would know that they were just making it up. And it was just one of many times that they tried to make something up, both to get, you know, attack the other side, because what was going on for them was not so pleasant or not so popular, to distract from whatever the Biden administration had been doing. And if I remember correctly, they then used this as a pretext to try and pass an absolutely absurd voting rights law in Congress that failed. And so it was another kind of PR weapon. And now, you know, of course, that moment has passed. They used it and tried to try and get whatever they wanted. It failed, at least. But now there's proof that they were just making it up all along.
Yeah, Charlie, it's especially annoying. I mean, this isn't a new point, but to have the center left totally obsessed with the idea of disinformation, as we've talked a lot about, especially in recent weeks. You know, The Atlantic has a conference about it. They're going to have a disinformation czar, and this lie can be spread. And it wasn't just advocates in opinion pieces. It was flat out news reports just accepted the premises of the advocates that this was going to harm the African American vote. And by the way, the minority vote in particular is up markedly in the early voting and the absentee voting. It was just accepted as fact and as truth, and everyone moves on when it's falsified. The Washington Post, to its credit, had a piece on the voting surge saying, okay, this doesn't jibe with what was said about the voting law. But the New York Times just ran a story about the vote being up without mentioning that anyone had criticized the voting law or said that this was going to be impossible or the vote was going to be suppressed.
There's two steps to this sort of deceit. The first is the story itself, that's in Georgia. And the next step is the use of that story to justify a broader claim, such as the one that was made earlier this year when Senate Democrats tried to abolish the filibuster to push through a federal law that would have essentially overturned every state's rules and pointed to Georgia as justification for it. And it has been important as such for those who aren't enthralled to this nonsense to categorically reject it. I can remember when this first came up, writing a piece saying, poor Brad Raffensperger. He'd just come off an election in which he was accused baselessly by Donald Trump and much of the Republican establishment of having facilitated massive fraud and allowed an election to be stolen. And no sooner had he finished dotting the I's and crossing the T's than this came up, which was also a lie. In fact, we should probably add a third one in, because Stacey Abrams did it in 2018 as well. This was never true. And it was always important to say when it was raised, this isn't true. This is a lie. This is a conspiracy theory. This is fake. This is a moral panic. The Democratic Party at some point recognized that it wasn't working and dropped it. As you say, they've moved on, which you would not do if it were real. You would keep going. Just think back to January when Kyrsten Sinema made that speech from the Senate floor saying, I'm not going to end the filibuster. Think of the headlines and the wailing and the gnashing of teeth that resulted from that. Now think when you last heard about that bill. It might be referenced obliquely, but no one's standing in the Senate talking about that. They've moved on, perhaps to abortion. Think about the wailing and gnashing of teeth and headlines from last year. We had to move the All-Star Game out of Atlanta. Stacey Abrams was the celebrity du jour. Corporations were weighing in. And then it went away. And again, that's how you know that something is fake. Abortion didn't go away. It spurred a 50-year fight. Gun control on both sides didn't go away. It spurred a 50-year fight. Many of the fault lines in our politics over which we argue relentlessly are still fault lines precisely because there is something there on both sides of the plate. But there isn't here. This was always nonsense. And you know, the fact that we are now seeing evidence, hard evidence, that it was nonsense is annoying, but it shouldn't be surprising because once you started looking at the text of the law that was passed, and indeed, once you started presenting the people who were making these complaints with the text of the law that was passed, they backtracked into, well, we don't trust the intentions of the people who wrote it, which is not a good way of analyzing statute.
So, Zan, we also have these actual primaries going on with various people running that are highly consequential, especially the gubernatorial primary on the Republican side. As Charlie mentioned, there is an effort to go after Raffensperger and Kemp in the wake of the 2020 election to get them to shake something loose, to bend it to Trump's will, to say the election was stolen, not to certify it, to decertify it. All this, we heard the Raffensperger call that someone on Raffensperger's end recorded and released to the press. That was the tip of the iceberg. I mean, this was going on constantly. Kemp was getting similar calls all the time. And Trump targeted Kemp in particular. Major focus of his ire, he recruited David Perdue, the failed Senate candidate, lost ironically, largely due to Trump undermining faith in the system and dispiriting Republican voters in the runoff in 2020. Perdue runs just as the Trump vendetta candidate and really hasn't gotten any traction. He kind of bumped up a little bit in the polls initially. I don't know, maybe his mid-high 30s. And now it's just crashed. Everyone can see what's going to happen. This is going to be a crushing victory for Brian Kemp. What do you make of it?
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting test case because we've certainly seen over the last, I guess, year in particular in some of these primary contests that Trump's endorsement still does matter. It's not like he's totally lost any kind of influence or power on the right, but it's not kind of the decisive game-changing type thing. Maybe in some races it could put someone over the edge. I would say maybe it helped Vance in Ohio where there's a really tightly contested primary and a number of candidates. But I don't think it works as kind of a pure, let's fuel one candidate as the Trump guy against somebody who Trump hates and has had a crusade against even before this particular election started. I don't think the Trump phenomenon is still powerful enough to affect that kind of victory. It certainly isn't working with Perdue, and Perdue was a senator in Georgia, so it's not like he's some, you know, nobody. But I don't think it's working. And I don't think we've seen plenty of times, even before 2020, that the Trump kind of gene doesn't translate. When you have a candidate try to run as kind of the Trump of North Dakota or the Trump of whatever, that doesn't really work. You know, you might be able to talk about certain policy ideas or kind of the working class rhetoric or some of the, you know, foreign policy the way Trump did, but you can't be the Trump guy in a way that actually, you know, causes you to win an election. I think in this case, we're seeing it's just not really ever going to work.
So, Jim, the exception, or we were talking about this Friday on the podcast, but I'll repeat. So Trump can give you a bump, you know, 10, maybe 20 points. If you are a pretty good candidate with flawed candidates around you, this can make a huge difference, you know, in a multi-candidate field. We saw it with J.D. Vance. But if you're flawed, like, you know, Dr. Oz, who'd already taken a lot of incoming based on not being a conservative, especially not being a socially conservative, you know, he might pull that race out in Pennsylvania. He's ahead very, very narrowly. But Trump's endorsement, you know, if you win by 500 votes, you can say, oh, that was Trump's endorsement that did it, obviously. But it didn't create major separation with McCormick, didn't deliver the race to him. Madison Cawthorn's another example, flawed guy, you know, loses by a couple points. Trump's endorsement didn't put him over the top. And then you have this category of Trump trying to go after entrenched popular Republican governors. And that's just really hard. He couldn't do it in Idaho against Brad Little. He's not going to be able to do it tonight against Brian Kemp. And I'll have to say, Kemp was in here for an editorial meeting at NR headquarters, which I happen to be where I'm recording today. He's a hugely impressive guy, a really impressive guy. And he played a crucial role in 2020. That was not easy for him just to stand on principle and say repeatedly, no, Mr. President, under, you know, the harshest and most severe kind of pressure you could imagine. And he's governed as a conservative, and he stood up to these woke corporations. You know, he's very proud of the fact that he was standing up, as he'll tell you, against woke corporations before Disney was a big deal. You know, he dealt with the Major League Baseball pulling out from the All-Star game. And it's just been a really impressive guy. And voters in Georgia know that. And also, your incumbent governor, you have this whole infrastructure of political influence and power that's on your side. All these appointees, all these lobbyists, et cetera, et cetera. So it was always going to be really hard for Trump to go after Brian Kemp. And he's not going to break his sword on this one because, you know, his influence will live on, but it's going to be an embarrassing night for him.
It will, Rich. And I wrote a bit about this on Friday. One of the odd things is I don't think we can necessarily measure the power or influence or popularity of Trumpism in the Republican Party at this moment based on Trump's endorsements, because Trump's endorsements aren't always the most Trumpy candidate in the race. There's kind of, it sometimes seems very fickle and arbitrary and all that stuff. And I think your assessment of Trump being, you know, can Trump's endorsement win you a primary? Well, I think when all is said and done, it's going to be a mixed bag. And people don't like that. People really prefer the cable news, rock'em sock'em robots. Trump's endorsement guarantees you'll win. Trump's endorsement doesn't mean anything anymore. And it's, as usual, it depends a lot on the quality of the candidates. It's worth, you know, Trump's going to tout some record. He's going to say, it's like 88 wins to 3 losses. We're still awesome, you know, kind of stuff. And, you know, the thing is that Trump endorses almost every incumbent congressional Republican. And surprise, surprise, incumbents win almost all their primaries and incumbents win almost all their general elections. So, you know, something that's in the neighborhood, most years it's in the neighborhood of 90%. Sometimes it's well ahead of that. So when you look at Trump saying, oh, look at how great my endorsement record is, keep in mind only a handful of those are competitive. And then there's other cases where you'll have like a Herschel Walker where, you know, did Trump's endorsement help him? Yeah. Was Trump's endorsement, if Trump had endorsed somebody else against Herschel Walker, would that have put somebody else above him? I'm very skeptical of that. Mm-hmm. I think when you've won a national championship at the University of Georgia, and you're one of the greatest college football players of all time, you won the Heisman Trophy, and you went on to become a, you know, very successful NFL running back, you're very popular, and it's going to give a big advantage over a bunch of other candidates who just aren't as well known. So then you look at the candidate where it really is competitive. And I think you can point to a couple examples, but I think Dr. Oz stands out as there are even a bunch of, you know, diehard MAGA Trump fans in the state of Pennsylvania who are like, what are you doing? There's nothing Trumpy about Dr. Oz at all, other than the fact that he's a celebrity. All kinds of speculation about why Trump endorsed Dr. Oz, including a report that Melania is a big fan of him and probably had Trump's ear for some of that. But look, you know, McCormick's wife, Dina Powell, worked in the Trump administration for a long time. McCormick wanted that endorsement for a good long stretch. And, you know, up until 20 minutes ago, not only was Mehmet Oz not a Republican. There's nothing conservative about him. And I don't think there's anything particularly populist or nationalist about the, maybe he's a Turkish nationalist. I think even, that was a bridge too far, even for a bunch of Trump fans. And then you mentioned the example of Madison Cawthorn. Look, you didn't need to have a crystal ball to tell that Madison Cawthorn was in trouble in this. He had, earned the ire and frustration of many Republicans in the 11th Congressional District. And Trump chose to stick his neck out and say, give this, he's made a bunch of mistakes, but give him one more chance. And the voters in the district were like, no. So, Trump at one point, people asked him about the Oz endorsement. I imagine the question was something in the lines of, are you sure you want to do this? And Trump said, I'm a gambler, or at least that's what the account said. And he is. He is not always picking the safe choice. A bunch of these, incumbents with a little, no-name primary challengers, he is. But, backing Mehmet Oz is not the safe bet. Backing Madison Cawthorn is not the safe bet. And encouraging David Perdue to run against Kemp was not the safe bet. And he's losing a bunch of them. He does not have fantastic instincts. He does not have the power to take a relative long shot or underdog and put them over the top. So I think the Trump endorsement, you'd rather have it than not have it, but it's not decisive. And I think it's something of an indicator that I don't think you can say it's not Trump's party anymore. I think generally most, it's still pretty powerful in Republican primaries and things like that. But I have examples like Kemp and other ones kind of demonstrate, you don't need Trump.
The most hilarious and potentially damaging thing that might happen to Trump tonight is if Mo Brooks finishes first in the Alabama Senate primary after being unendorsed by Trump when he was lagging in third, and then having this amazing surge after Trump pulled his endorsement would be kind of amazing.
A bunch of Trump's endorsements are really him trying to pick the winner and then being able to take credit for that guy winning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Charlie?
I think that explains some of his endorsements, Jim. But one of the reasons that his portfolio, if you will, is so unbalanced and slapdash is that, as ever, the characteristic that Donald Trump values above all others is loyalty, fealty even. And he is therefore looking for sycophants rather than candidates. And in the case of, say, Dr. Oz, he put himself on the wrong side of a number of issues that are important to Republicans. He, of course, doesn't have great judgment, and one doesn't need to have great judgment if one chooses one's candidates based on one's relationship to them. That might explain a Madison Cawthorn. But he's not like a talent agent. I'm sure that he has some skill in this area, but it mostly attaches itself to him. Donald Trump is unique, and he senses how he can navigate politics and slough off the rough edges. I'm not sure he thinks too hard about how other people will do that. So, I'm not surprised to see a mixed bag, because Trump is not looking at this with the interests of a given set of policy preferences at heart. He's not looking at this with the interests of the institutional Republican Party at heart. He's looking at this from a self-centered perspective, and the candidates that he's chosen reflect that.
So, Zan, ask a question to you. Rate your level of satisfaction over a Brian Kemp victory, which presumably is impending tonight, from 0 to 10. No big deal. You can take it or leave it. 10, a cosmic level of satisfaction.
Yeah, I would say maybe a 7. I mean, it's encouraging. I think it does show that the kind of the Trump grievance candidate, let's call it, is not going to be much of a factor. And I think that's a good thing. But I don't think it's a sign that Trump's influence is totally gone. So I'm not, super, super thrilled.
Jim Garrity.
The answer is 42. Mm-hmm. And it's not merely because of, it's a Trump loss. It's also that the argument against Kemp never got into any other aspect of policy. Perdue's entire campaign was, if Kemp had tried hard enough, Trump would be president today, which was always an asinine and nonsensical argument. And he never really developed any other broader critique of Kemp as governor.
So, Jim, actually, one other thing, let me throw at you real quick. What do you make of Pence's declaration of independence from Trump? Clearly, this was coming for a while, but it was made official in a New York Times piece where Pence says he'll consider running against Trump in 2024 if it comes to that.
You know, it seemed like news when Jonathan Martin wrote about it in the New York Times, but I seem to recall Pence saying something to our John McCormick a couple weeks, months ago, which is why you should always read National Review so you can know what the New York Times is going to report. But yeah, no, I think at some point, maybe many years from now, a really interesting story. Mike Pence's autobiography could be really interesting because he does not act like a guy who is supremely proud of his service as vice president and can't wait to see Donald Trump get back into the Oval Office. Having an angry mob try to kill you can have that kind of effect on a man's view on life. And I have this sneaking suspicion that he now believes that Trump made a terrible, you know, it was, you know, in fact, the critics were right, that he was not prepared for the job, that he was not capable of the job, that he's too reckless, too erratic, too obsessively, you know, focused on his grievances, things like that. And I think, I think it's extremely unlikely that Mike Pence is the 2024 Republican presidential nominee. I do wonder if Mike Pence runs and says, folks, you thought it was bad. You didn't see what I saw behind the scenes. This man cannot be president, and that's why I'm running against him. I think that might have a kamikaze effect on a Trump campaign and to redound to the benefit of a Ron DeSantis type or something. But who knows what the future holds.
Charlie Cook, 0-10 on Kemp.
I think it's a 10. First, because Brian Kemp's been a good governor of Georgia, and the Republican Party should want to nominate and elect and celebrate good governors. And good governors, incidentally, mean different things in different places. You're not going to get the same sort of governor in Georgia or Florida or Texas as you get in Maryland. And second, because it would show that there is a limit to the influence of the Trump wing of the party, but also that relitigating 2020 is just not that important to people when it is put up against concrete achievement and a record, which Brian Kemp has. You know, if this primary season had seen Madison Cawthorn renominated and David Perdue unseat Brian Kemp, I think it would have been disheartening. It would have said that Republican primary voters are fixated on the past. Well, maybe in a few cases they are, but they seem not to be as motivated by all that nonsense as one might think.
Yeah, I think it's a clear 10. Kemp did the right thing in 2020 in a way that will redound to his credit throughout history, literally. And then he escaped the threatened political consequences from Trump and his allies, because he's going to win the primary and he's going to win the general election. I feel very strongly in this year he's going to defeat Stacey Abrams, who has not shown a deft political touch lately, to say the least. I mean, she the other day said Georgia is the worst state to live in the country, which is completely absurd and a very weird thing to say if you live in that state and seek to lead that state. So all honor to Brian Kemp. I hold what I said on Friday, you know, maybe a MAGA party rather than a Trump party per se, but Trump will win the nomination of a MAGA party, I would think, kind of going away if he wants it in 2020, unfortunately. With that, let's pause and hear from our second sponsor this episode, Tommy John. Is the summer heat melting your ice cube? Stay frosty where it counts in brand new Tommy John underwear, because when you wear Tommy John, you're that much cooler, so you can do everything better thanks to breathable, lightweight fabric with four times the stretch of competing brands. With dozens of comfort innovations, Tommy John will keep you looking and feeling cool all season long, from lounging at home to summertime fun. That's why Tommy John doesn't have customers. It has fanatics. With over 17 million pairs sold, people love their Tommy John underwear and loungewear, and Tommy John doesn't just make you feel cooler, you actually are cooler. Stay up to 7 degrees, that's 7 degrees cooler than cotton, and Tommy John's Apollo underwear. Plus, there's no risk
because you're covered with Tommy John's best pair you'll ever wear, or it's free guarantee. Shop TommyJohn.com/editors right now for 20% off your first order. Get 20% off right now at TommyJohn.com/editors, TommyJohn.com/editors. See the site for details and please check it out. So, Zan, Joe Biden is loose once more in the world on this Asia trip. Obviously, hugely important region, hugely important relationships he's trying to buttress, hugely important message he's trying to send to China about how we're trying to ring fence its hegemonic ambitions in the region. And because it's Joe Biden, and because he's out there, and because he's answering questions, and because he's saying things, he stepped in it in a hugely embarrassing way, said that when asked if we would defend Taiwan militarily, he said yes, and seemed to suggest this is long-time U.S. policy when it's not. And immediately the White House had to clean it up and say, no, he was just referring to our long-time policy. This isn't anything new. This is the place we've been for 40 years. What do you make of it?
Well, I had two thoughts after I heard this news. The first was that it's obviously extremely concerning to have a president who's going around regularly at this point saying things that are simply not true, that are then walked back by other people who are clearly more in charge and more aware of what's going on than the president himself. This could obviously lead some very unpleasant places. So it's concerning. But then my second thought was, this is the second presidency in a row where, when it comes to foreign policy, we have a president whose word is not taken seriously. And in the case of Trump, maybe it was, I don't know, I can't really figure out which is more or less concerning of the two. But with Trump, it was, well, he might change his mind tomorrow and say something totally different, or, you know, he might be surrounded by people who won't ever follow through on this particular impulse that he has today. And with Biden, it's because he doesn't seem to have any idea what's going on half the time, or perhaps more than half the time. So it's I guess, more of the same, but for a different reason.
By the way, forgive any of the ambient noise, especially sirens you might be hearing. I am recording this from our New York City office, and there's always a lot going on in New York City that you can hear despite the best efforts of the incomparable Sarah Schitte. So, Jim, this is just another case where Joe Biden's supposed to be a professional, right? He's been at this for his entire adult life. He's been on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. I'm sure he was chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee at some point. I can't remember. And your imperative should be, as president, don't overstate U.S. policy. Just stick to the talking points on the stuff where you're supposed to stick to the talking points. And he can't manage to do it. I think you've done this. This is several times he's done this on Taiwan. Maybe it shows, you know, I'm sure it does show his true reflex and what he believes we should do. But if we're going to have a new policy, let's have a new policy. Otherwise, don't say there's a new policy when there's not.
Rich, I think the most succinct phrase to describe this phenomenon is, for God's sake, this man cannot remain in power, as Biden famously said of Biden. And look, I think what the recent comments about Taiwan.
Biden, of Putin. It would have been nice if he'd said it of Biden.
At some point, he might say it of himself.
This is probably the worst gaffe that Biden has made in the foreign policy arena in 20 minutes or so. This is now a habit, and at first, I'd say this can't go on, but obviously it can go on. Joe Biden is just going to get up in front of a podium, in front of audiences at home and abroad, and whatever thought pops into his head, he's going to blurt out, regardless of the foreign policy consequences. We won't react that much if Russia makes a minor incursion into Ukraine or something like that. Now, this is one of those rare times where, look, I think, and at this point, on this one, I was ready to give Biden a little bit more slack, because I think everybody, from Beijing to Washington and every place in between, knows that if, you know, an hour from now, Chinese forces started moving in the direction of Taiwan, the United States would not just shrug their shoulders and say, oh, well, that stinks, nothing we can do about it. We'd do something, right? And I think we had recently a cover piece on how much the US was obligated to defend Taiwan. There's probably some disagreement, but we would be doing something. Intelligence sharing, shipping them arms, perhaps stationing a carrier in the neighborhood. We would not just say, I guess we really do have a one China policy now, and just shrug our shoulders and stuff like that. So when Biden says this, he's not saying anything that's really some giant state secret or something. But we've now turned into this recurring phenomenon, formerly of Jen Psaki, and now I assume Jean-Marie Pierre is going to be in this situation where she's got to, you know, it's, you know, clean up on aisle six. You know, what, and inevitably comments that come out as grandpa gets confused. He didn't take his pills this morning. Pay no attention to his recent statement that we would defend Taiwan. Our policy is the same, yada, yada, yada. And you end up in this situation in which what Biden says has no particular consequence on what U.S. policy is. And the president just travels around the world spouting things off until they can shuffle him off to, you know, back some back room and eat tapioca and watch a Matlock rerun. This is bad. This is really, you know, there's a time and a place for strategic ambiguity. And this is not one of them. Unfortunately, there's no indication that this is getting any better. And I would say, well, maybe some other administration officials can kind of step into the breach. But let's face it, the idea of getting a clear statement from Kamala Harris is laughable.
Now, Charlie, perhaps the upside of this is that if we have a policy of strategic ambiguity on the question of whether we're going to defend Taiwan or not, Joe Biden has done more than his share to increase the ambiguity, right? But this is a hugely consequential question, and one that shouldn't be, I'm sure you of all people believe, decided on by the President of the United States on his own. You know, if we're going to defend Taiwan in what would be probably a major war with China, that has to be a national decision that everyone is bought into and that Congress is bought into. Meet the Press, I think maybe it was Meet the Press Daily podcast, or maybe it was The Real Show. I'm not sure. I was listening to it on my podcast app on my phone, so I wasn't sure. But they had a special devoted to a war game of a U.S. defense of Taiwan and what would happen. And it, you know, my faith in war games is a little shaken now because there are all these reports that the U.S. would lose a war with Russia in Europe in various war games, which obviously those war games were not very, very accurate. But anyway, these war games got to, you know, China attacking Hawaii really quickly, you know, and conducting a nuclear test to show that the nuclear option was very much in the table very quickly. So this is a hugely consequential decision, might be the most consequential one the United States will make, you know, in the next 50 years. So you can't have the president freelancing on it, one, and you can't have the executive branch deciding it on its own.
I certainly agree about the role of the executive branch and probably don't need to re-rehearse that argument for our listeners. I will defend Joe Biden a little in that he is now in the company of three of the last four presidents who have in some way stepped in it on the question of Taiwan. If you go back to 2001, just before 9/11, George W. Bush seemed to imply pretty much the same thing as Biden did. April 25th, 2001, he was asked on an ABC interview what his position on Taiwan would be, and he said whatever it took to help Taiwan defend herself if it were invaded by China. And the follow-up question was whether the United States would use the full force of the American military in such an eventuality. And George W. Bush, who was president at this point, said whatever it took to help Taiwan defend herself. And this caused something of a stir. I think this got forgotten pretty quickly because of the horrors of that September. George W. Bush was not alone in stirring the pot with Taiwan. If you remember, just before Trump became president, he took a call from the president of Taiwan, Tsai Ing-wen, whom he called in a tweet the president of Taiwan, congratulating him for winning. Now, I think a lot of the coverage of this was silly, but he created ambiguity in America's position. He was the first president who had ever taken such a call. And the way he talked about it afterwards seemed to horrify a good number of national security people, although obviously not all of them. And I mention this because while I agree entirely that Biden is all over the place and that we should not have somebody with his total inability to reason in the position he occupies, American presidents seem to struggle with this because it is a question with which Americans should struggle. It's a difficult one. Do you want to say no out loud? Forget for a moment who sets policy. Of course, it should be Congress. Do you want to say no? Create some invitation. Do you want to say yes, thereby committing yourself? All of the strategic instincts, the historical instincts, the moral instincts here are to say, we will defend Taiwan. That's how America sees itself. It's how America has behaved in other circumstances over and over again. So while I agree that George W. Bush should not have said what he said in April of 2001, and while I agree that President-elect Trump's behavior was clumsy, and I agree that Joe Biden's comments are unhelpful, I think it would be unfair to put this down to crazy, senile old Joe. The only president who has not fallen into this trap now in 22 years is Barack Obama.
Mm-hmm.
And that has to say something about how complex and tricky an issue this is for the United States. Now, of course, the way you get around that is to elect better people into the presidency and to have those people and the American public and the Chinese government understand that this policy is set by Congress. I'm not excusing Biden or Trump or George W. Bush, but I would be nervous in turning this into a purely Biden-led gaffe. I think that Biden is ill-equipped to deal with what is and has been a problem for a long time.
So, Zan, that's a pretty compelling semi-defense of Joe Biden from Charlie. And a segue to the exit question. You're president of the United States, Zan. China invades Taiwan. Do you defend Taiwan militarily? Yes or no?
Well, I hate that you came to me first because I wanted to learn from other people on this one. But I think that I would. I don't think that it's an easy call, but I think that I would.
Jim Garrity.
The answer is yes, we'd be taking action in some form. I think what we're seeing, the way Ukraine is defending against Russia, is sort of a textbook for how the Taiwanese could basically make any attempted Chinese occupation absolutely miserable. We probably would be trying to figure out ways to smuggle in weapons. And in fact, we're probably stockpiling the weapons they have, the sort of things that would be good for launching an insurgency and things like that. But whether, I think we'd also like not be taking direct action against the Chinese. We'd basically be doing what we can, maybe cyber intelligence sharing, everything short of directly shooting at them.
And that's what you do?
I think so, yeah. President.
Charlie?
I would certainly call the Speaker of the House and the Senate Majority Leader and ask them for permission to take action, yes.
You declare war on China?
I would ask Congress to give me permission at a level that it thought was appropriate to respond to an invasion of Taiwan.
This is this is now the Charlie doctrine. No future hypothetical president will be able to hew this line, this subtle line.
Look, we make it clear in the Constitution that Congress is in charge of this matter. And I think what we've done in recent years is narrow the concept of war to the point at which we either have a declaration of war or we have nothing. And that doesn't track, in my opinion, with the way the Constitution is structured. I think that irrespective of whether you have a state of war, which has certain meaning in an international context, you nevertheless need permission to take actions that might implicate the country or drag it further into war or make demands on the treasury. So I think that this is not clearly in that gray area that I don't have much time for, but I understand people who are very educated do, where a president doesn't have time to ask Congress, or the United States is so clearly implicated that it triggers the supposed inherent powers of the executive branch. Taiwan is worth defending in my estimation. But Taiwan is not an American state. It's not within the sphere of influence covered by the Monroe Doctrine. I think the president would have to go to Congress and ask for permission. And I hope that a president would ask, and I hope that Congress would grant it.
But you'd defend it.
If I were asked to make that call, either as a president or a legislator, yes, I would defend it.
So I'm divided on this one. I think I would say no. I just wonder whether these relatively peripheral places end up being as important as they seem. I'm a little skeptical of the idea that all the dominoes in East Asia would fall into China's lap if it took Taiwan. I think you'd likely see the kind of reaction against China that you've seen against Russia in Europe, where everyone is totally freaked out and alarmed and gets much more serious about checking the threat rather than bandwagoning with the hostile power. I'm skeptical of whether we'd win a war with China at an acceptable price. The acceptable price for China is going to be much higher than what it is for us. This is something that's much more meaningful to them, that they're much more committed to taking Taiwan, if it comes to that, than we'd be to defending it. So my answer at the moment is no. I reserve my right fully to change my mind and be persuaded otherwise. So a clever friend of mine suggested a couple of weeks ago to me, you know what Taiwan really needs to do is, which it's actually tried to do a couple times in the past and we've shut them down, is have a clandestine nuclear program and show up one day with some nukes and then be able to really defend itself and deter China. But then another well-informed friend of mine said, oh, that's never going to work because there are so many spies in Taiwan, the Chinese would immediately find out. That's one of the red lines for China, and you'd actually precipitate the event you'd be trying to deter, because that would be totally unacceptable to China. And even if Taiwan shows up one day with a nuclear weapon, China will probably be able to take it out before it's launched against China. So that clever answer is apparently off the table, at least as far as I'm concerned. But at the moment, I'm with Jim. You know, I do everything to buttress the Taiwanese in such conflict, but I don't think I'd directly involve the U.S. military. With that, let's pause and hear from our last sponsor this episode, our good friends at Quip. Good health starts with good habits. Quip makes it easy by delivering all the oral care essentials you need to care for your mouth. The Quip electric toothbrush is loved by over 7 million mouths and has timed sonic vibrations with 30-second pulses to guide a dentist-recommended 2-minute clean, a lightweight and sleek design with no wires or bulky charger to weigh you down, a multi-use travel cover that doubles as a mirror mount for less clutter, reusable handles and a range of sleek metal hues, as well as bright plastic colors sure to make a pop to your bathroom counter. On top of your brushing, you can upgrade your Quip with a new smart motor to track and improve your brushing. With the free Quip app, earn amazing rewards like free refills, products, Target gift cards, and more. Beyond the brush, Quip has everything you need to build a complete routine, including anti-cavity toothpaste and mint or watermelon that helps prevent cavities, and two ways to floss, floss drain that expands to clean, a reusable floss pick that replaces over 180 disposable picks with every refill. In addition to brush heads, Quip also delivers fresh floss, toothpaste, mouthwash, and gum refills every 3 months from $5. Shipping is free, so you can save money and skip the hustle and bustle of in-store shopping with stylish and affordable electric brushes starting at just $25. And these things are fantastic. They are a feature of the Lowry household. I can't recommend them highly enough. You won't be paying through the teeth for better oral health. If you go to getquip.com/editors right now, you'll get your first refill free. That's your first refill free at getquip.com/editors, spelled getquip.com/editors, Quip, the good habits company. So Charlie, we have another notable cancellation. Classics professor, highly respected, Joshua Katz at Princeton University. This one is a little bit of a new twist because there is a consensual affair that has been used against him and to get around his tenure and fire him, which happened yesterday. This pretty obviously relates to a piece he wrote in Quillette 2 years ago at the height of the frenzy after the killing of George Floyd, pushing back against these ridiculous demands that were made by various folks about how Princeton needed to become even more woke and more anti-racist. He included a line referring to the Black Justice League, this African-American student group on campus, as a local terror group. I don't think should have called them a terror group, but compared to other hot-tempered things various people have said, this doesn't really rate. So they go back and relitigate a affair that had already been litigated. He had a consensual relationship with a student. This had took place sometime in 2004, 2005, something like that. 10, 15 years later, it emerges. He is suspended by Princeton. And then the Quill Ed article comes out. The Daily Princetonian goes digs into this relationship, purports to find all sorts of additional damaging facts around this relationship. And Princeton purports to investigate and then purports to be have no choice but to act and fire him for this past relationship he'd already been punished for. What do you make of it?
I view this as a form of what I've called cultural double jeopardy. I add the prefix cultural because, of course, double jeopardy is a legal concept that applies only to criminal law. But we have laws because we believe that the underpinning ideas that they reflect are good. So just as it is true that the First Amendment applies to the government and not to private institutions, we still should expect free speech of our private institutions, because free speech is a good. And I think that while Princeton or the Acme Company of North Dakota are unburdened by legal double jeopardy rules, they should nevertheless accept the idea that led to their having been set in legal aspect, that being that when a given inquiry or investigation is complete, when a punishment has been meted out, that should be the end of the matter. We don't want a country in which people who have made a mistake are punished or acquitted of that mistake, and then spend the rest of their lives wondering if at some point in the future it will be relitigated. That's why we don't allow people to be tried twice for the same crime unless there are substantial changes to the terms of the original investigation. We don't want some guy who makes a mistake, goes to prison for 3 years, wondering if a new governor will come in and use something that he has said or done as an excuse to go back to the well. And we shouldn't want that culturally either. Joshua Katz broke the internal rules at Princeton. He didn't break a law. This wasn't a Title IX question. He broke the internal rules at Princeton by declining to tell that university that he had had a consensual relationship with a student. The matter was investigated and he was punished for it. He spent a year on suspension. The issue was then closed. Subsequently, Joshua Katz said some things that the students and administration, and presumably all those DEI drones that are now ruining all of America's institutions, didn't like. And so they used the previous infraction to get rid of him. This is illiberal. This is totalitarian. And anyone who believes that there was, in fact, new evidence, new important evidence that came to light, that this was not the product of his speech, that this was not pretextual, is a fool. Now, I've said before on this podcast that I'm not particularly sold on the idea of tenure. I understand that among my fellow classical liberals, tenure is fairly popular. I've never really understood it. I can't count the number of times I've seen professors with tenure say genuinely offensive things and then be defended on the grounds that they had tenure. A few years ago at Rutgers, there's a professor named Brittany Cooper who tweets as Professor Crunk. And she said she hates white people and they were villains. And she said that we got to take these mother effers out. And the response to criticism was, well, she has tenure. All right. As I say, I'm not sold on this as a concept, but if we have it, let's have it. Let's allow tenured professors to say pretty much whatever they want without revenge. But let's not have that only for one side. Let's not allow the side that hides behind tenure to then leverage other tools to get rid of the people that it doesn't like, to hear their speech and to circumvent the bubble of protection that tenure provides. Because that's what's happened here. That's what's happened at Princeton. This is not about Joshua Katz's relationship with a student for which he was already punished. This is not about new information coming to light. This is about a university president who has said for a long time that he favors free speech and that tenure protects free speech, finding another way to placate the mob, weaponizing other tools within his armory to placate the mob. And I think that if this is to be the way it is going forward, then we will need to revisit how this whole setup works.
So, Zan, this is a kind of represents a melding of a distortion and weaponized version of Me Too with traditional cancel culture.
Yeah, it is. And this is something that kind of when Me Too started, I think most people were glad to see horrible men being brought to justice finally, especially when these stories had been buried for so long. But there certainly was kind of an undercurrent of concern, particularly with the kind of, the conjoined notion that came along with Me Too of believe all women. And one could, support women being able to come forward. And if the stories are credible and corroborated and all that, the men being brought to justice. But we were also supposed to believe, according to many proponents of this idea, that any woman who comes forward with any story about any man is telling the truth. And we don't need to investigate further than that. Obviously, Kavanaugh was the best example of this idea. It doesn't actually really matter if the facts line up, doesn't matter if we can even prove that they knew each other. If a woman says he did it, then he did it and he has to be punished in whatever form we all decide is acceptable. We all meaning the left. And so I think we are right to be concerned. People are right to be concerned that this would be weaponized or used in an unfair way against men who, committed some kind of wrongthink. And this is an example of it happening because as we've said already, he served his time, so to speak, right? The issue came to light. He was punished under the rubric laid out by the people who created this infraction or decided that this would be an infraction. And then everyone moved on and no new information came to light. We all know that no new information came to light. And they're just doing this because it's a convenient pretext for punishing someone who had the wrong ideas. And so I think it's very problematic that something that started out as a good idea, I think a step forward for justice can't be done in a way that detangles it or disentangles it from punishing people whose ideas we don't like.
Jim Garrity.
So I have three thoughts on this. My first is the question of what exactly is the purpose of a university in the year of our Lord, 2022? I'm sure I've triggered a bunch of people by using the phrase in the year of our Lord, because it sure as heck isn't free inquiry. The moment you've got speech codes, the moment you've got, these angry mobs being riled up over a professor saying something, it clearly isn't free inquiry anymore. In fact, year by year, case by case, it looks more and more like universities have decided it's not their job to prepare young people for other things in life, prepare people for the workforce, things like that. No. The job of the university is to lead this political, philosophical, and social revolution to change the rest of society. And if that's the case, well, I don't understand why the heck the federal government at any level would be funding this. And also you raise the question of whether parents would want to spend utterly exorbitant fees to this purpose. But by and large, for a long time, there was this philosophy of you go to for your college or university, you get trained how to get a good job, and you end up in the white collar and you live a happy middle class suburban life, or wherever you want to live, life for the rest of your life. That's what it was supposed to do. It was not supposed to indoctrinate you. It's not supposed to transform your way of thinking so that you saw everything in this woke, awakened, you know, identity politics, perpetual outrage approach to life. Second thought. So Princeton's going to go after every professor who's banging a student, huh? And we're not just picking out this guy because of his views. It's going to be every professor. Okay, we've checked on all of them. Just checking. All right. Make sure. Because clearly he's the only guy who would do that, right? There's no way any other professors at Princeton are doing that. I don't have any inside information on this. I just figure, considering the long history of professors and students, that the idea, this is not a rare one-off amongst professors at this school or any others. And then thirdly, I just kind of think about every time we see a university president knuckle under to the woke crowds, or in some cases just eagerly embrace the angry demands of the woke crowds. I'm kind of left when, you know, Jeffrey Goldberg decided to can our good friend Kevin Williamson after a couple of weeks at The Atlantic. What's the point of running an institution if you don't really get to make personnel choices? I imagine the right to assemble your all-star team of the staff that you want, of the people you want, whether it's professors you want to have at a university, or whether it's the writers you want to have at a magazine, or whatever it is. I figure one of the joys of being in charge is being able to hire and fire who you want, and put together the way you want. I imagine something like fantasy football, right? You've got your ideas of people you think would be great on one team together, you put them all together, and now apparently you don't. Now the HR department, the hiring and firing, is really done by the most radical students on campus. They get veto power. And if they get mad enough, they get to overrule your decisions. Now, the great irony is that all they can do is sit around, bang their drums and protest and all that stuff. Sooner or later, they'll have to get on with their lives. If a Jeffrey Goldberg or university president type wanted to say, no, I'm in charge here. I'm in charge here for X number of years. If you don't like it, you can take it up with the board of directors, but I've decided I want to hire the professors I want to have. And these are the professors I want to have. And if you don't like it, you don't have to take their classes. And if you don't like it, you can go to some other school. But until this moment, I'm going to hire the best professors I want. These are the best professors. And why don't you sit down and learn something instead of marching around the campus with your big signs? Oh, yeah. Wait, apparently no university professor in the country is capable of doing that, other than maybe Mitch Daniels.
So Charlie Cook, exit question to you. I'm the dean of liberal arts at a highly prestigious, let's say an Ivy League school. I come to you and say, Charlie, I love your stuff at NRO. I am offering you a tenured position on the faculty of this Ivy League school. Maybe have to teach two or three classes a week. Do you take that job? Yes or no?
I take that job if there's a clause in there that says if they fire me for any reason, I instantly get $5 million.
Zan, do you take that job?
I don't know. I guess I would. That seems like a pretty normal standard of employment, I guess. So I guess I would.
Jim Gearty.
Rich, the first problem with your hypothetical is, what the hell am I going to teach?
Political science, Jets, come on.
Advanced Jets misery?
You're being offered the head of the political science department at Yale. Do you take it, yes or no?
Why would they talk to me? Anyway, I think something akin to Charlie's, because I figure, considering the state of the mood on most campuses, not just Yale, that my tenure will be my time in that position will be measured in milliseconds before some sort of angry mob gathers and the faculty loses whatever little spine it has left.
Yeah, in isolation and in theory, it's how could you say no to that offer? I mean, it'd be utterly fantastic. Personally, my late father was a professor, so I've always had a hankering, you know, is that something I could do at some point? But in reality, as Jim says, you know, who would last in that job, who has our views? And even if you lasted, you'd have to live in fear. You'd have to live in fear. I remember a couple of years ago, I was on a political program, you know, just doing punditry. And this was sometime after the 2016 election. And I referred to Hillary Clinton not being likable. And, you know, you see sometimes you say something that is you can't say, and you just look at the faces around you, just looking at shocked, you know, or you know, look of pity in their eyes. How could he have made this grievous mistake? I was like, what did I say? Yeah, I didn't say that out loud. I was like, what? And I didn't realize that it had become forbidden to say that Hillary Clinton is unlikable, which she is. But this would be your entire existence, you know, every single Zoom call, every single class, every single faculty lunch. So it'd just be an intolerable existence. So, but if the University of Austin wants to, when they get underway and they want to come make this offer, I hope that they don't make this offer to any of my colleagues, because I don't want any of them to leave. But maybe that would be truly, truly tempting. But this would not be a happy existence. So with that, let's hit a few other things before we go. Zan, you went to the beach.
I did, yes. I was off last week, and I was grateful to the Supreme Court for not totally ruining my week off by releasing the Dobbs decision early.
Yeah, you were grateful to the Supreme Court for not doing the thing you've spent your entire career desperately praying just for, and it would have been inconvenient for you.
Just not yet. But yeah, I guess I would have been excited at the end of the day if it had come out the way I wanted. But in any event, we went to the Outer Banks, which is in North Carolina. I went there quite a few times as a kid, but I hadn't been in a long time. Went down there for the week, and I will sound like an old person for saying this, but I'll probably be mocked anyway, so I might as well just say it. The shelling there is not as good as Sanibel Island, Florida, which is where we went on our honeymoon.
No, I agree. The shells are Sorry, you've won me over with that.
It's not.
You just went there.
Yes. Yeah, last May.
Isn't that Sanibel Island bird?
Yeah.
Sanibel Island's lovely. Everyone should go to Sanibel Island.
Yeah, it was great. But the Outer Banks was great too.
So Jim Garrity, big flag football doubleheader.
Yes, it was this past weekend, and I am proud to say that my younger son's flag football team is 5-0 on the season. Wow. And I'd really like
That's not like the Arizona Cardinals last year.
Yeah, well, I'd really like to say that my younger son is the centerpiece of the team. But that wouldn't really be accurate. On the good games, he's a valuable role player. But I think what really struck me about the last game was, you know, Sunday was super hot here in Northern Virginia, humid, beginning of summer, just kind of hits you like a wet mop in the face. And they're out there playing on what's usually a high school football field. They kind of do it not lengthwise, but widthwise as the size for these guys. My son is in the 12 and under league. And not only did he cover, you know, he's got the job of covering not just a big kid on the other side. We're at that age where certain kids have hit puberty and are sprouting and some are not. So it's not just that the kid on the other side that he had to cover was taller. Guys, I'm fairly certain this kid drove himself to the game. He shaved at halftime, all right? Now it's like, okay, all right, my son can handle him. He's pretty good. He's pretty quick. But when he started talking about doing two terms in Afghanistan, then I'm like, okay, I think we got a ringer. Nonetheless, they managed to eke out two victories in humid weather, still 5-0, and looking very good for the playoffs.
Charlie Cook, you went to see the Jacksonville Jumbo Shrimp.
I did. This is a minor league team in Jacksonville. And they were playing the Durham Bulls.
Of classic.
Of Bull Durham fame. They won 5-3. It was a great day out. I learned some things. I didn't know that when they were the Suns, Tom Seaver had played for them.
Oh, wow.
And Hank Aaron. It's a big, yeah. It's a big memorial to Hank Aaron. It's a great day out. They did face painting for the kids. They made balloon animals. It's all included in the ticket price. They had a bounce house. You could go throw on the field before the game started. It was a doubleheader because the game before had been rained out. So we got two games for the price of one.
I hope seven inning doubleheaders.
That's right. That's right. I don't like that bit, but I did text you, Rich, and say that I'm not that averse to a pitch clock, having seen it in practice. It didn't detract from the game. I'll concede. I don't know if it would be different in Major League Baseball. I can't see why it would, but certainly in minor league baseball, that doesn't detract. The best thing about the Jacksonville Jumbo Shrimp is that when the team wins, they play a almost perfectly faithfully re-recorded version of the Tina Turner classic Simply the Best that is, and I kid you not, Shrimply the Best. They have reworked all of the lyrics. The first time I heard it, I was crying laughing.
That's great. What a wonderful piece of Americana. So speaking of non-American sports, I've been transfixed by the Edmonton Oiler Calgary Flames playoff series. I'm a hockey fan, but usually not enough to really be that much into the playoffs when the Caps are inevitably bounced after the first round, as they have every time since they won their Stanley Cup. But this has just been an amazing series. First game, 9-6. Calgary
got jumped out to a huge lead in that game, 6-6 something or other. And Edmonton came all the way back and tied it 6-6. This is hockey, and you know, it's not baseball. And then Calgary finished them off 9-6, 15 goals in a playoff game. I mean, that's unheard of. Next game was 5-3 Edmonton. They were losing 2-0 immediately, then 3-1, came all the way back. Just 8 goals in that one. And we've gone all the way down to a defensive gem the other night, a 4-1 Edmonton victory back in Edmonton, but 5 goals. So they play again tonight, and I can't wait to watch it, because you just kind of sit down on the couch saying, okay, I can spend 5 minutes here, because I know someone is probably going to score a goal. And Connor McDavid is an absolute marvel. With that, it's time for our editor's picks. Jim Garrity, what's your pick?
Well, I was very tempted to go with Kevin Williamson's latest, but I realized I think I picked him last week. So I'm going to go with my distinguished colleague's Charlie Cook's recent column. Biden's COVID policy is incoherent, but that's politics. Charlie walks through a bunch of different ways in which the administration's still in place COVID-19 policies really don't make sense. Sometimes they contradict each other. And I just liked the way Charlie summarizes it very succinctly. On the surface, the president's decisions seem inexplicable, but dig a little deeper and you'll discover that they are the product of a near-perfect marriage between the usual bureaucratic inertia and Joe Biden's crippling fear of his own party. Even now, more than a year since he became president, his instinct is to leave everything be until it is killed by a court, crushed by public pressure, or taken up as a cause by the progressive movement. In just a few sentences, Charlie summarizes the entire Biden administration, and everyone should read it.
Zan, what's your pick?
My pick is, I believe, the most recent forgotten fact check by Isaac Shore and Brittany Bernstein. And it's called Media Aim to Rewrite Catholic Teachings After Pelosi Denied Communion. This piece just really, it's great. It alleviated all my frustrations at the typical round of misunderstandings and, I think, intentional misconstruals of the Catholic Church that we typically see from mainstream outlets.
Charlie.
I'm going to choose the whole of our most recent issue of the magazine, which is about life after Roe, assuming it's struck down. I hope every Republican, or in fact, every pro-life politician, they don't have to be Republicans, despite the best efforts of the Democrats to expel them, read this issue. It puts paid to the lie that those who oppose abortion have not thought for a single moment about what happens after birth. Clearly, those who wrote in this issue, Alexander is among them, have thought quite deeply about that question and have put together a whole host of ideas.
So when Jim said he was going with Charlie Peace, I was worried he was going to pick a Princeton Classics professor gets railroaded, but he didn't. So it's still open for me. This was just a classic, no pun intended, Charlie Cook piece where you get illiberalism and violations of due process, and Charlie is truly in his sweet spot, and this was a righteous takedown of Princeton and what they've done here. So that's it for us. You've been listening to a National View podcast. Any rebroadcast, retransmission, or account of this game without the express written permission of National View Magazine is strictly prohibited. This podcast has been produced by the aforementioned incomparable Sarah Schutte. Makes it sound better than we deserve. Thank you, Charlie. Thank you, Jim. Thank you, Zan. Thanks to Allegiance Gold, Tommy John, and Quip. And thanks especially to all of you for listening. We're the editors. We'll see you next time.